Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilia, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show, online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, a man who is the Susan Boyle of the education policy community, Howie Schaefer.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here, but I've been kissed.
You've been kissed. Is that right? See, you know, so, you know, she is a YouTube sensation, and that's how I'd like to describe you as well,
Howie. Oh, thank you.
But let's tell our listeners here a little bit about yourself. Most people probably know you best as the person who was responsible for the Public Education Network News Blast that goes out to some, I don't know, 50,000 million people.
Yeah, right? No, we were proud of our readership, and it was my little baby. So I consider myself an informed observer. I'm not a policymaker or an expert. So if I channel anything, it's something that I read that some other brilliant person has written. It's not my own.
Oh, that humility. And lately you've been working for a variety of groups in education, helping them with
education
writing,
and also diversity and inclusion and mm-hmm. cultural competency, which is an emerging area in both business and schools. And
you know, I'm glad that you brought that up, because I just heard from a colleague that last week at the American Education Research Association meeting, that this colleague heard a new term being used. The term was people of gender as a way to refer to women. Now, I mean, is this only at the AERA that you would hear this, or is this a growing trend within the diversity movement?
No, that's the first time I've heard it. It sounds like an ivory tower thing to me.
No. So, we'll ask again. Well, Christina, as a person of gender, do you like that title?
Is that not particularly.
That sounds like, you know, like I'd rather be, call me bald if you want. I'm not.
Of no hair.
Person of no follicles.
Yes, so I am vertically challenged myself. Okay, well, we got a lot to cover. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We are going to hear the Research Minute from Amber, and we're going to rate that reform. Christina, let's get started.
Topic number one. This week marks the 10th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre. A decade later, are our schools generally safer? If so, why is that?
I think that schools are generally safer. If you follow most of the studies and polls, teachers, students, parents all report feeling safer in schools. There's two ways to look at the problem as far as I've seen it and observed. There's the reaction mode, what happens after a high-profile incident happens, and schools sort of hunker down, they go into PR mode, and they do lots of aggressive investments. And we've seen how that plays out: security cameras, canine dogs, handheld metal detectors, policies that make it more effective for teachers to spend time, or more possible for teachers to spend time in professional development. But what we haven't done is the prevention side. Another Columbine is not a question of if, but really when. There is a lot of alienation among youth out there, and it's just below the surface. And we see it in the context of bullying and other pieces. And I really worry that we're not doing the right things that we need to make kids and families and streets in our country safer.
Sure, but you know, alienated youth is not a new thing. I mean, it's a theme in American literature that goes back a long, long time. I guess the difference is, you know, whether there's now availability to destructive weapons that wasn't there in the past. But it does seem like schools now know that, you know, if a kid hears a rumor about something like a Columbine, they know to tell an adult, and those adults know to take it seriously, and that seems, I mean, I don't know, is it just an impression I have that there haven't been as many of these horrible incidents lately as there seemed to be 10 years ago?
Well, in the case of Columbine, actually, the Jefferson County Police ignored warning signs. They had warrants, you know, and for the arrests of certain people, and they just didn't go after them. And the same is true. The warning signs only look like warning signs in retrospect. And so we live in a very violent society, and schools are mirrors of society.
Next topic. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court heard a case about whether Arizona is meeting the terms of a federal statute that requires a certain level of services for English language learners. Chief Justice John Roberts wondered whether a district court should be allowed to say to a state legislature, quote, you've got to spend this money on this program, and I don't care what it means for jails, roads, or anything else, unquote. Should courts be able to say that?
Well, this one, I figure we can get a good debate going here with Howie, my lefty friend. end. So this, I love this question from John Roberts. I reminded me of a few years ago when he said this divvying us up by race is a sordid business. You know, one of the things he gets to do as Chief Justice is say things that might have an impact on our discourse and politics and conversation. And here he is saying, in a federal case, you know, does it make sense for the courts to have this right to require state legislators to spend a certain amount of money on education? An even bigger question is really at the state level, where there are state constitutional requirements around equity or adequacy. And we've got state courts all the time telling legislatures, you have to spend X dollars on education. But isn't it the legislators, the democratically elected people that are supposed to weigh these various priorities, be able to say, look, we're in an economic recession right now, for example. We've got to decide how much money should go to education, how much money should go to welfare services, how much money should go to the prison system. I mean, that they've got to be the ones making those decisions, not judges who, you know, don't have any particular expertise in any of these areas.
Well, people always want to say, oh, these activist judges, you know, they're getting out ahead of themselves and they're making policy, or they're taking away the executive branch's enforcement role. And that's a
right.
I think that that's a bit of a ruse. The reason that the school districts are and the courts are in this position is because school districts have been inactive. They have not done what has been asked of them, or even what's required of them. And there's a great tradition of this.
And okay, but in this case, it's about states. They're saying that the states have failed to act in terms of providing enough money for the schools. And they, therefore, the states have either decided that the money should go to other services instead, or they have decided not to tax the citizens as much as the courts think they need to. I mean, should courts be in that business?
I think they need to be if we're talking about protecting the rights of students. I think it's a very simple question. Whether it's a state court or whether it's a federal court, they're still in the position of having to protect the constitutional and due process rights of students. And if it takes resources away from other priorities, then we're going to have to go through the process of finding those sorts of elected officials who see public education as being a priority.
Well, that I would agree with, that if you believe that we should spend more money in education, you should go about getting people elected who share that view and want to go ahead and raise taxes or do what it takes. But I don't think the answer is to go to the courts and say that the education system has a certain right that, say, the healthcare system or the prison system don't have those same rights. I think that's very dangerous. Third topic.
Last week, the Council of Chief State School Officers and the National Governors Association announced that 41 states were on board with a move to create common national standards. Is this a big deal? Will this result in a national test? And what are the chances that it will be any good?
Well, this is a big question, and a lot of people who are close observers are giving shout-outs to Walter Isaacson in Time magazine for writing sort of a very moderate, middle-of-the-road piece, and he hauls out the old yarn, of course, that conservatives hate the word, you know, national, and liberals hate the word standards. I think that that's a little bit unfair. I think the real snake in the grass, since we only have 90 seconds here on this one, is the assessment piece of this, and that is, are we going to have a narrowly defined set of measures that we use, or are we going to have a much broader, more comprehensive set? That's really the question, is the assessment piece. My personal view is that I would love to see a national test, but I'd love to see it be a basic proficiency test. And then communities can build upon that, embellish upon it locally as per their needs. In the case of Virginia, for example, they have local standards to teach local Virginia history. There's nothing in a national test that would prevent that, but I would like to have a basic national proficiency exam so that we can really take the temperature of the nation.
Well, that's very interesting. Well, in fact, Fordham has a study coming out soon, and a big conference on this issue, where we are trying to look to other countries to see what we can learn. How do they get the balance between national and local? In their national standards of tests, do they try to cover it all?
And does national mean federal?
And does national mean federal? But it's interesting. I mean, I kind of get the sense of what you're talking about with the assessment. I mean, the worry that we're just doing what, fill-in-the-blank tests or that. But it seems like one of the benefits of going national is that you could have the resources to actually develop a real state-of-the-art assessment that could do more than just fill in the blank, that could, you know, really try to get at, you know, the higher order thinking skills that everybody believes are important.
Or but social also get or emotional measures and factors as well, too. I know that people hate that.
Or emotional
factors? I know.
You know, we're going to ask kids how they feel?
Yeah.
Oh, Howie.
We'll hug it out later.
Howie. I love it. I'm so glad to have you on the show. This is, because I don't, you know, I agree with Rick about lots of things, but we're going to take the emotional and social. Wow.
Well, if you're concerned about school violence, it might be important to know where kids are on some of those measures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, talk about, you know, Bo, one time a year, we're going to find out. Johnny, how are you feeling today?
Well, it's better than no time a year. But it's not going to be a substitute for all the informal assessment that constantly goes on in the classroom.
Well, that's right. That's right. Okay, well, good. Well, that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly, Howie. Thank you. You know, I found your responses to be quite crisp and to the point. Are those talking points that you have written down there in front of you? Or those,
I have the new teleprompter app on my iPhone.
Nice. <Yeah. laughs> Nicely done. Okay, well, please stay here and join us for the next segments, because this is where it gets really good, Howie. We are now here for Amber's Research Minute. Of course, Howie, I didn't have to tell you that, because I know you are a loyal listener of the podcast